remember, but under the spell of his playing, Artemus Entreri had several times managed to clear his thoughts of all the normal clutter. A short while later, the sun much lower in the sky, the assassin lowered the flute and stared at it. Somehow, the instrument didn't sound as fine as on those other occasions he'd tested it, nor did he find himself being drawn into the flute as he had before. "Perhaps the wind is countering the puff of your foul breath," Jarlaxle said from behind him. The drow couldn't see the scowl that crossed Entreri's face. Was there ever to be a time when he could be away from that pestering dark elf? Entreri laid the flute across his lap and stared off to the west and the lowering sun, the bottom rim just touching the distant horizon and setting off a line of fires across the dark teeth of the distant hills. Above the sun, a row of clouds took on a fiery orange hue. "It promises to be a beautiful sunset," Jarlaxle remarked, easily scaling the boulder and taking a seat close beside the assassin. Entreri glanced at him as if he hardly cared. "Perhaps it is because of my background," the drow continued. "I have gone centuries, my friend, without ever witnessing the cycles of the sun. Perhaps the absence of this daily event only heightens my appreciation for it now." Entreri still showed no hint of any response. "Perhaps after a few decades on the surface, I will become as bored with it as you seem to be." "Did I say that?" "Do you ever say anything?" Jarlaxle replied. "Or does it amuse you to let all of those around you simply extrapolate your words from your continuing scowls and grimaces?" Entreri chortled and looked back to the west. The sun was lower still, half of it gone. Above the remaining semicircle of fire, the clouds glowed even more fiercely, like a line of fire churning in the deepening blue of the sky. "Do you ever dream, my friend?" Jarlaxle asked. "Everyone dreams," Entreri replied. "Or so I am told. I expect that I do, though I hardly care to remember them." "Not night dreams," the drow explained. "Everyone dreams indeed at night. Even the elves in our reverie find dream states and visions. But there are two types of dreamers, my friend. Those who dream at night, and those who dream in the day." He had Entreri's attention. "Those night dreamers," Jarlaxle went on, "they do not overly concern me. Night dreams are for release, say some, a purging of the worries, or a fanciful flight to no end. Those who dream in the night alone are doomed to mundanity, don't you see?"
"Mundanity?"
"The ordinary, the mediocre. Night dreamers do not overly concern me, because there is nowhere for them to rise. But those who dream by day, those, my friend, are the troublesome ones."
"Would Jarlaxle not consider himself among that lot?"
"Would I hold any credibility at all if I did not admit my troublesome nature?"
"Not with me."
"There you have it, then," said the drow. He paused and looked to the west, and Entreri did too, watching the sun slip lower. "I know another secret about daydreamers," Jarlaxle said at length.
"Pray tell," came the assassin's less than enthusiastic reply.
"Daydreamers alone are truly alive," Jarlaxle explained. He looked back at Entreri, who matched his stare. "For daydreamers alone find perspective in existence, and seek ways to rise above the course of simple survival." Entreri didn't blink.
"You do daydream," Jarlaxle decided. But only on those rare occasions your dedication to...
To what, I often wonder,
allows you outside your perfect discipline.
Perhaps that dedication to perfect discipline is my dream.
No, the drow replied without hesitation. No. Control is not the facilitation of fancy, my friend. It is the fear of fancy.
You equate dreaming and fancy, then?
Of course. Dreams are made in the heart and filtered through the rational mind. Without the heart,
control,
and only that. A pity, I say.
I do not ask for your pity, Jarlaxle.
The daydreamers aspire to mastery of all they survey, of course.
As I do.
No.
You master yourself and nothing more, because you do not dare to dream.
You do not dare allow your heart a voice in the process of living.
And Trary's stare became a scowl.
It is an observation, not a criticism, said Jarlaxle. He rose and brushed off his pants. And perhaps it is a suggestion. You, who have so achieved discipline, might yet find greatness beyond the feared reputation.
You assume that I want more.
I know that you need more, as any man needs more, said the drow. He turned and started down the backside of the boulder. To live, and not merely to survive, that secret is in your heart, Artemis and Trary. If only you are wise enough to look.
He paused and glanced back at Intrary, who sat staring at him hard and tossed the assassin a flute, seemingly an exact replica of the one Intrary held across his lap.
Use the real one, Jarlaxle bade him. The one Ilnazara gave to you. The one Idalia fashioned those centuries ago.
Idalia put a key inside this flute to unlock any heart, Jarlaxle thought, but did not speak, as he turned and walked away.
And Trary looked at the flute in his hands and at the one on his belt. He wasn't really surprised that Jarlaxle had stolen the valuable item and had apparently created an exact copy.
No, not exact, and Trary understood, as he considered the emptiness of the notes he had blown that day.
Physically, the two flutes looked exactly alike, and he marveled at the drow's work as he compared them side by side. But there was more to the real creation of Idalia. A piece of the craftsman's heart.
And Trary rolled the flute over in his hands, his fingers sliding along the smooth wood, feeling the strength within the apparent delicateness.
He lifted the copy in one hand, the original in the other, and closed his eyes. He couldn't tell the difference. Only when he blew through the flutes could he tell, in the way the music of the real creation washed over him and through him, taking him away with it, into what seemed like an alternate reality.
Wise advice.
A voice to the side of the trail greeted Jarlaxle as he moved away from his friend. Not caught by surprise, Jarlaxle offered Mariabrone a tip of his great hat and said,
You listened in on our private conversation.
Mariabrone shrugged.
Guilty as charged, I fear. I was moving along the trail when I heard your voice. I meant to keep going, but your words caught me. I have heard such words before, you see, when I was young and learning the ways of the wider world.
Did your advisor also explain to you the dangers of eavesdropping?
Mariabrone laughed, or started to, but then cleared his throat instead.
I find you a curiosity, Dark Elf. Certainly you are different from anyone I have known, in appearance at least. I would know if that is the depth of the variation, or if you are truly a unique being.
Unique among the lesser races, such as humans, you mean?
This time, Mariabrone did allow himself to laugh.
I know about the incident with the knee breakers, he said. I am certain that I do not know of what you speak.
I am certain that you do, the ranger insisted.
Summoning the wolf was a cunning turn of magic, as returning enough of the years to Hobart to ingratiate yourself while keeping enough to build your legend was a cunning turn of diplomacy.
You presume much.
The signs were all too easily read, Jarlaxle. This is not presumption, but deduction. You make it a point to study my every move, of course.
Maria Brown dipped a bow.
I, and others.
The drow did well to keep the flicker of alarm from his delicate features.
We know what you did. But be at ease, for we pass no judgment on that particular action. You have much to overcome concerning the reputation of your heritage, and your little trick did well in elevating you to a position of respectability. I cannot deny any man or drow such a climb. It is the end of that climb you fear?
Jarlaxle flashed a wide smile, one that enveloped the whole spectrum from sinister to disarming, a perfectly non-readable expression.
To what end?
The ranger shrugged, as if it didn't really matter. Not then, at least.
I judge a person by his actions alone. I have known halflings who would cut the throat of an innocent human child, and half-orcs who would give their lives in defense of the same. Your antics with the knee-breakers brought no harm. For the knee-breakers are an amusing lot, whose reputation is well solidified. And they live for adventure and not reputation in any case. Hobart has certainly forgiven you. He even lifted his mug in toast to your cleverness when it was all revealed to him.
The drow's eyes flared for just a moment. A lapse of control. Jarlaxle was unused to such wheels spinning outside his control, and he didn't like the feeling. For a moment, he almost felt as if he was dealing with the late Matron Bayenry, that most devious of dark elves, who always seemed to be pacing ahead of him or even with him. He quickly replayed in his mind all the events of his encounters with the knee-breakers, recalling Hobart's posture and attitude to see if he could get a fix upon the point when the halfling had discovered the ruse. He brought a hand up to stroke his chin, staring at Maria Brown all the while and mentally noting that he would do well not to underestimate the man again. It was a difficult thing for a dark elf to take humans and other surface races seriously. All his life, Jarlaxle had been told of their inferiority, after all. But he knew better than that. He'd survived and thrived by rising above the limitations of his own prejudices. He affirmed that again, taking the poignant reminder in stride.
"The area is secure?" he asked the ranger. "We are safe enough."
The drow nodded and started back for the camp.
"Your words to Artemis and Treri were well spoken," Maria Brown said after him, halting him in his tracks. "The man moves with the grace of a true warrior and with the confidence of an emperor. But only in a martial sense. He is one and alone in every other sense. A pity, I think.
I am not sure that Artemis and Treri would appreciate your pity.
It is not for him that I express it, but for those around him."
Jarlaxle considered the subtle difference for just a moment, then smiled and tipped his hat. Yes, he thought. And Treri would take that as a great compliment. More's the pity. The ground was uneven, sometimes soft, sometimes hard, and full of rocks and mud, withered roots and deep puddles. The drivers and riders in the wagons bounced along, rocking in the uneven sway of the slow ride, heads lolling as they let the jolts play out. Because of the continued jarring, it took Entreri a few moments to detect the sudden vibration beneath his cart, sudden tremors building in momentum under the moving wheels. He looked at Jarlaxle, who seemed similarly awakening to the abrupt change. Beside the wagon, Ellery's horse pawed the ground. Across and to the front, the horse of one guard reared and whinnied, hooves slashing at the air. Mario Brone locked his horse under tight control and spurred the creature forward, past Ellery and Entreri's wagon, then past the lead wagon.
"Ride through it and ride hard," the ranger shouted. "Forward, I say, with all speed!"
He cracked his reins over one side of his horse's neck, then the other, spurring the animal on. Entreri reached for the whip, as did the woman driving the front wagon. Jarlaxle braced himself and stood up, looking around them, as Ellery regained control of her steed and chased off after Mario Brone.
"What is it?" Entreri bade his companion.
"I'm feeling a bump and a bit of a shake,"
yelled Athrogate from the back of the wagon in front.
"I'm thinking to find a few monsters to break."
Entreri watched the dwarf bring forth both his morning stars with a blazing, fluid movement, the balls immediately set to spinning before him. Athrogate lost all concentration and rhythm a split second later, however, as the ground between the wagons erupted and several snake-like creatures sprang up into the air. They unfurled little wings as they lifted, hovering in place, little fanged mouths smiling in hungry anticipation. The horse reared again, and the poor rider could hardly hold on. Up leaped a snake creature right before his terror-wide eyes. He instinctively threw his hands before his face as the serpent spat a stream of acid into his eyes. Down he tumbled, his weapon still sheathed aside his terrified, leaping horse, and all around him more winged snakes sprang from holes and lifted into the air. Streams of spittle assaulted the man, setting his cloak smoldering with a dozen wisps of gray smoke. He screamed and rolled as more and more acid struck him, blistering his skin. His horse leaped and bucked and thundered away, a group of snakes flying in close in hungry pursuit. Beside the gray-haired man, Davis Aang kept his horse under control and crowded in to try to shield his fallen comrade, but more and more winged snakes came forth from the ground, rising up to intercede. Out came Davis Aang's broadsword, and a quick slash folded one of the hovering snakes around the blade and sent it flying away as he finished through with his great swing. But another snake was right there, spitting into the soldier's face, blinding him with its acid. He swept his blade back furiously, whipping it about in a futile effort to keep the nasty little creatures at bay. More venom hit the man and his mount. Another pair of snakes dived in from behind and bit hard at the horse, causing it to rear and shriek in pain. The soldier held on but lost all thoughts of helping his prostrated companion. That prone man continued to squirm under a barrage of acidic streams. He clawed at the ground, trying to get some traction so that he could propel himself away. But a snake dived onto his neck, wrapping its body around him and driving its acid-dripping fangs into his throat. He grabbed at it frantically with both hands, but other snakes dived in fast and hard, spitting and biting. Entreri shouted out, and the horses snorted and bucked in terror and swerved to the right, moving up along the uneven and rising foothill. "Hold them!" Jarlaxle cried, grabbing at the reins. The wagon jolted hard, its rear wheel clipping a stone and diving into a deep rut. The horse team broke free, pulling the harness from the frame and taking both Jarlaxle and Entreri with them, for the moment at least. Both kept their sensibilities enough to let go as they came forward from the jolt and tug, and neither was foolish enough to try to resist the sudden momentum. They hit the ground side by side, Entreri in a roll and the drow landing lightly on his feet and running along to absorb the shock. Entreri came up to his feet in a flash, sword and dagger in hand and already working. He set opaque veils of ash in the air around him, visually shielding himself from the growing throng of winged snakes. Streams of acidic spittle popped through the sheets of black ash, but the assassin was not caught unaware. Already turning and shifting to avoid the assault, he burst through hard, catching the snakes by surprise as they had tried to catch him. A slash of Karin's claw took down a pair, and a stab of his jeweled dagger stuck hard into the torso of a third. That snake snapped its head forward to bite at the assassin's wrist, but Entreri was a flash ahead of it, twisting his hand down and flicking the blade to send the creature flying away. Before the creature had even cleared from the blade, the assassin was on the defensive again, slashing his sword to fend a trio of diving serpents and to deflect three lines of acid. More came at him from the other side, and he knew he could never defeat them all. He surrendered his ground, leaping back down the hill toward the two dwarves and the thin man, who had formed a triangular defensive posture in the back of the rolling wagon. Athrogate's twin morning stars moved in a blur, spiked metal balls spinning fast at the end of their respective chains. He worked them out in a round with tremendous precision, never interrupting their flow, but cunningly altering their angles to clip and send spinning any snakes that ventured too close. Athrogate let out a series of rhyming curses as he fought, for lines of acid spittle assaulted him, sending wisps of smoke from his beard and tunic. Pratkis stood behind him, deep in prayer, and every now and then he called out to Moradin, then gently touched his wild bodyguard, using healing magic to help repair some of his many wounds. To the side of the cleric, the thin man waggled his fingers, sending forth bolts of energy that drove back the nearest creatures. And Treri knew he had to catch that wagon. "Make way," he cried, cutting fast to the side, coming up even with the back of the wagon as he leaped atop a rock. Athrogate turned fast, giving him safe passage onto the bed. Before the dwarf could yell, "Hold the flank!" and Treri went right past him, between the other dwarf and the thin man. He scrambled over the bench rail to take a seat between the two drivers, both of whom were ducking and screaming in pain. And Treri threw the hood of his cloak up over his head and grabbed the reins from Callahay. The half-elf woman was obviously blinded and almost senseless. "Keep them away from me," he shouted to the trio behind. He bent low on the seat, urging the horses on faster. Parissus, sitting to Entreri's right, mumbled something and slumped in hard against him, causing him to twist and inadvertently tug the reins and slow the team. With a growl, Entreri shoved back, not quite realizing that the woman had lost all consciousness. She tumbled back the other way and kept going, right over the side. Entreri grabbed at her but couldn't hold her and hold the team in its run. He chose the wagon. The woman rolled off, falling onto the front wheel with a grunt, then a second grunt as the back wheel bounced over her. Callahay cried out and grabbed at Entreri's arm, yelling at him to stop the wagon. He turned to glower at her, to let her know in no uncertain terms that if she didn't immediately let go of him, he'd toss her off the other side. She fell back in fear and pain, then screamed again as another stream of acidic venom hit her in the face, blistering one cheek. "Hold on, hold on!" That was all the poor, confused Davis Aang could think as the assault continued. Gone were his hopes for aiding his fallen friend, for he rode on the very edge of doom, disoriented, lost in a sea of hovering, biting, spitting serpents. Lines of blood ran down his arms and along the flanks of his horse, and angry blisters covered half his face. "Abominations of Zheng Yi!" he heard his beloved commander yell from somewhere far, far away, too distant to aid him, he knew. He had to find a direction and bolt his horse away, but how could he begin to do anything but hold on for all his life? His horse reared, whinnied, and spun on its hind legs. Then something hit it hard from the side, stopping the turn, and the soldier lurched over and could not hold on. But a hand grabbed him hard and yanked him upright, then slid past him and grabbed at his reins, straightening him and his horse out and leading them on. So great was Maria Brown's control of his mount that the horse accepted the stinging hits from the abominations, accepted the collision with David Aang's horse, and carried on exactly as the ranger demanded, finding a line out of there and galloping away. On the ground behind Maria Brown, the fallen soldier kept squirming and rolling, but he was obviously beyond help. It pained Maria Brown greatly to abandon him, but there was clearly no choice, for dozens of snake creatures slithered around him, biting him repeatedly, filling his veins with their venom. The horses could outrun the creatures, Maria Brown knew, and that was this other soldier's, and his own, only hope. The warrior woman cried out, bending low and slashing her axe through the air as her horse thundered on toward the soon-to-be-overwhelmed drow. He worked his arms frantically and magnificently, Ellery had to admit, sending a stream of spinning daggers at the nearby snakes. He spun continually as well, his cloak flying wide and offering more than nominal protection against the barrage of acidic venom flying his way. Still, he got hit more than once and grimaced in pain, and Ellery was certain that he couldn't possibly keep up the seemingly endless supply of missiles. She bent lower, winced, and nearly fell from her seat as a stream of caustic fluid struck the side of her jaw, just under the bottom edge of her great helm. She kept her wits about her enough to send her axe swiping forward to tear the wing from another of the snakes, but a second got in over the blade and dived hard onto her wrist and hand. Hooked fangs came forth and jabbed hard through Ellery's gauntlet. The knight howled and dropped her axe, then furiously shook her hand, sending both the gauntlet and the serpent tumbling away. She shouted to the drow and drove her steed on toward him, reaching out her free hand for his. Jarlaxle caught her grip, his second hand working fast down low with a dagger, and Ellery's surprise was complete when she found herself sliding back from her seat rather than tugging the drow along. Some magic had gripped the dark elf, she realized, for his strength was magnified many times over, and he did not yield a step as her horse galloped by. She was on the ground in a flash, stunned and stumbling, but Jarlaxle held her up on her feet. "What?" she started to ask. The drow jerked her in place in front of him, and Ellery noted faint sparkles in the air around them both, a globe of some sort.
"Do not pull away," he warned.
He lifted his other hand to show her a black, ruby-tipped wand in his delicate fingers. The woman's eyes went wide with fear as she glanced over Jarlaxle's shoulder to see a swarm of snakes flying at them. Jarlaxle didn't show the slightest fear. He just pointed his wand at the ground and uttered a command that dropped a tiny ball of fire from its end. Ellery instinctively recoiled, but the drow held her fast in his magically enhanced iron grip. She recoiled even more when the fireball erupted all around her, angry flames searing the air. She felt her breath sucked out of her lungs, felt the sudden press of blazing heat, and all around her and the drow, the globe sparked and glowed in angry response. But it held. The killing flames could not get through. Outside that space, though, for a score of feet all around them, the fires ate hungrily. Serpents fell flaming to the ground, charred to a crisp before they landed. Off to the side, the wagon and Trary and Jarlaxle had unceremoniously abandoned, flared, the corn in the supply bags already popping in the grip of the great flames. Across the other way, the body of the fallen soldier crackled and charred, as did the dozen serpents that squirmed atop it. A puff of black smoke billowed into the air above the warrior and the drow. The wagon continued to burn, sending a stream up as well, its timbers crackling in protest. But other than that, the air around them grew still, preternaturally serene, as if Jarlaxle's fireball had cleansed the air itself. A wave of heat flashed past in Trary, the hot winds of Jarlaxle's fireball. He heard the thin man in the wagon behind him yell out in the surprise, followed by Athrogate's appreciative, "Good with a boom for clearing the room!" If the assassin had any intention of slowing and looking back, though, it was quickly dismissed by the plop of acidic spittle on the hood of his cloak and the flapping of serpent wings beside his ear. Before he could even move to address that situation, he heard a thrumming sound, followed by a loud whack, and the sight of the blasted serpent spiraling out to the side. The thrumming continued, and Entreri recognized it as Athrogate's morning stars, the dwarf working them with deadly precision.
"I got your back! I got your head!" came the dwarf's cry. "Them snakes attack ye! They wind up dead!" "Just shut up and kill them," Entreri muttered under his breath, or so he thought.
A roar of laughter from Athrogate clued him in that he had said it a bit too loudly. Another serpent went flying away right past his head, and Entreri heard a quick series of impacts, each accompanied by a dwarf's roar. Entreri did manage to glance to the side to see the remaining woman, fast slipping from consciousness, beginning to roll off the side of the wagon. With a less than amused grimace, Entreri grabbed her and tugged her back into place beside him. Entreri then glanced back and saw Athrogate running around in a fury. His morning stars hummed and flew, splattering snakes and tossing them far aside, launching them up into the air or dropping them straight down to smack hard into the ground. Behind the two dwarves, the thin man stood at the back of the wagon, facing the way they had come and waggling his fingers. A cloud of green fog spewed forth from his hands, trailing the fast-moving wagon. The serpents in close pursuit pulled up and began to writhe and spasm when they came in contact with the fog. A moment later, they began falling dead to the ground.
"Aye!" the other dwarf cried. "Poison the air, ye clever wizard," said Athrogate. "Choking them, stinking, spitting, lis—" "Don't say it," Entreri shouted at him. "What?" the dwarf replied. "Just shut up," said the assassin.
Atheragate shrugged, his morning stars finally losing momentum and dropping down at the end of their respective chains.
"Ain't nothing left to hit," he remarked.
And Trary glared at him, as if daring him to find a rhyming line.
"Ease up the team," the thin man said. "The pursuit is no more."
And Trary tugged the reins just a bit and coaxed the horses to slow. He turned the wagon to the side and noted the approach of Mariabrone and the wounded soldier, the ranger still handling both their mounts. And Trary moved around a bit more onto the flat plain, allowing himself a view of the escape route. The wizard's killing cloud of green fog began to dissipate, and the distant burning wagon came more clearly into sight, a pillar of black smoke rising into the air. Beside him, Callahay coughed and groaned. Mariabrone handed the soldier's horse over to the care of Atherogate, then turned his own horse around and galloped back to the body of the other fallen woman. Looking past him, and Trary noted that the other soldier was dead, for the man's charred corpse was clearly in sight. From the sight of the fallen woman, all twisted, bloody, and unmoving, the assassin gathered that they had lost two in the encounter. At least two, he realized. And to his own surprise, a quiver of alarm came over him, and he glanced around, calming almost immediately when he noted Jarlaxle off to the other side, up in the foothills, calmly walking toward them. He noted Ellery, too, a bit behind the drow, moving after her scarred and riderless mount. The wounded woman on the ground groaned, and Intrary turned to see Mariabrone cradling her head. The ranger gently lifted her battered form from the mud and set her over his horse's back, then slowly led the mount back to the wagon.
"Teresis?"
Callahay asked. She crawled back into a sitting position, widened her eyes, and called again for her friend, more loudly.
"Teresis!"
The look on Mariabrone's face was not promising, nor was the lifeless movement of Teresis limply bouncing along.
"Teresis!"
the woman beside Intrary cried again, even more urgently as her senses returned. She started past the assassin, but stopped short.
"You did this to her!"
she cried, moving her twisted face right up to Intrary's. Or trying to, for when the final word escaped her lips, it came forth with a gurgle. Intrary's strong hand clamped against her throat, fingers perfectly positioned to crush her windpipe. She grabbed at the hold with both hands, then dropped one low, to retrieve a weapon, Intrary knew. He wasn't overly concerned, however, for she stopped short when the tip of the assassin's jeweled dagger poked in hard under her chin. "Would you care to utter another accusation?" Intrary asked.
"Be easy, boy," said Atherogate.
Beside him, the other dwarf began to quietly chant. "If that is a spell aimed at me, then you would be wise to reconsider," said Intrary. The dwarf cleric did stop, but only when a drow hand grabbed him by the shoulder. "There is no need for animosity," Jarlaxle said to them all. "A difficult foe, but one vanquished."
"Because you decided to burn them all and your companion,"
accused the shaken, shivering half-elf soldier.
"Your friend was dead long before I initiated the fireball," said the drow. "And if I had not, then I and Commander Ellery would have suffered a similar fate."
"You do not know that!"
Jarlaxle shrugged as if it did not matter.
"I saved myself and Commander Ellery. I could not have saved your friend, nor could you in any case."
"Abominations of Zhenyi," said Mariabrone, drawing close to the others. "More may be about. We have no time for this foolishness."
And Trary looked at the ranger, then at Jarlaxle, who nodded for him to let the half-elf go. He did just that, offering her one last warning glare. Callahay gagged a bit and fell back from him, but recovered quickly. She scrambled from the wagon bench and over to her fallen companion. Mariabrone let her pass by, but looked to the others and shook his head.
"I got some spells," the dwarf cleric said.
Mariabrone walked away from the horse, leaving the woman with her fallen friend.
"Then use them," he told the dwarf.
but I doubt they will be of help. She is full of poison, and the fall broke her spine. The dwarf nodded grimly and ambled past him. He grabbed at the smaller Callahe, who was sobbing uncontrollably and seemed as if she would melt into the ground beside the horse.
"Perseus," she whispered over and over.
"A stream of drats for being her," Aphrodite muttered. "At least," said Jarl Axel. The sound of an approaching horse turned them all to regard Ellery.
"Marry a Brown with me," the commander instructed. "We will go back and see what we can salvage. I need to retrieve my battle axe, and we have another horse running free. I'll not leave it behind."
She glanced at the fallen woman, as Pratkis and Callahe were easing her down from the horse.
"What of her?"
"No," Maria Brown said, his voice quiet and respectful.
"Put her in the wagon, then, and get it moving along," Ellery instructed.
Her callous tone drew a grin from Entreri. He could tell that she was agitated under that calm facade.
"I am Canthan," he heard the thin man tell Jarl Axel. "I witnessed your blast. Most impressive. I did not realize that you dabbled in the art."
"I am a drow of many talents." Canthan bowed and seemed impressed. "And many items," Entreri had to put in. Jarl Axel tipped his great hat and smiled. Entreri didn't return his smile, though, for the assassin had caught the gaze of Callahe. He saw a clear threat in her blue-gray eyes. Yes, she blamed him for her friend's fall.
"Come along, ye dolts, and load the wagon," Aphrodite roared, as Maria Brown and Ellery started off. "Be quick, afore Zhenyi attacks with a dragon! Bwahaha!"
"It will be an interesting ride," Jarl Axel said to Entreri, as he climbed up onto the bench beside the assassin.
"Interesting is a good word," Entreri replied.
Chapter 10 With Open Heart.
"At ease, my large friend," Wingham said, patting his hands in the air to calm the half-orc. But Ulger Khan would not be calmed.
"She's dying. I tried to help, but I cannot."
"We don't know that she's dying."
"She's sick again, and worse now than before," Ulger Khan continued. "The castle grows, and its shadow makes Arrayan sick."
Wingham started to respond again, but paused and considered what Ulger Khan had said. No doubt the somewhat dim warrior was making only a passing connection, using the castle to illustrate his fears for Arrayan. But in that simple statement, Wingham heard a hint of truth. Arrayan had opened the book, after all. Was it possible that in doing so, she had created a magical bond between herself and the tome? Wingham had suspected that she'd served as a catalyst, but might it be more than that?
"Old Nyungi, is he still in town?" the merchant asked. "Nyungi?" echoed Ulger Khan. "The tailspinner?"
"Yes, the same." Ulger Khan shrugged and said,
"I haven't seen him in some time, but I know his house."
"Take me to it at once."
"But Arrayan—"
"To help Arrayan," Wingham explained. The moment the words left his mouth, Ulger Khan grabbed his hands and pulled him away from the wagon, tugging him to the north and the city. They moved at full speed, which meant the poor old merchant was half running and half flying behind the tugging warrior. In short order, they stood before the dilapidated door of an old three-story house, its exterior in terrible disrepair, dead vines climbing halfway up the structure, new growth sprouting all over with its roots cracking into the foundation stones. Without the slightest pause, Ulger Khan rapped hard on the door, which shook and shifted as if the heavy knocks would dislodge it from its precarious perch.
"Easy, friend," Wingham said. "Nyungi is very old. Give him time to answer." "Nyungi!"
Ulger Khan yelled out.
He thumped the house beside the door so hard the whole of the building trembled. Then he moved his large fist back in line with the door and cocked his arm. He stopped when the door pulled in, revealing a bald, wrinkled old man, more human than orc in appearance, save teeth too long to fit in his mouth. Brown spots covered his bald pate, and a tuft of gray hair sprouted from a large mole on the side of his thick nose. He trembled as he stood there, as if he might just fall over. But in his blue eyes, both Olgercon and Wingham saw clarity that defied his age.
"Oh, please do not strike me, large and impetuous child," he said in a wheezing, whistling voice. "I doubt you'd find much sport in laying me low. Wait a few moments and save yourself the trouble, for my old legs won't hold me upright for very long."
He ended with a laugh that fast transformed into a cough. Olgercon lowered his arm and shrugged, quite embarrassed. Wingham put a hand on Olgercon's shoulder and gently eased him aside, then stepped forward to face old Nyungi.
"Wingham?"
the man asked.
"Wingham, are you back again?"
"Every year, old friend," answered the merchant. "But I have not seen you in a decade or more. You so used to love the flavors of my carnival."
"I still would, young fool," Nyungi replied. "But it is far too great a walk for me."
Wingham bowed low.
"Then my apologies for not seeking you out these past years."
"But you are here now. Come in, come in. Bring your large friend, but please do not let him punch my walls any more."
Wingham chuckled and glanced at the mortified Olgercon. Nyungi began to fade back into the shadows of the house, but Wingham bade him to stop.
"Another time, certainly," the merchant explained. "But we have not come for idle chatter. There is an event occurring near to Palishchuk that needs your knowledge and wisdom."
"I long ago gave up the road, the song, and the sword."
"It is not far to travel," Wingham pressed, "and I assure you that I would not bother you if there was any other way. But there is a great construct in process, a relic of Zheng Yi's, I suspect."
"Speak not that foul name!"
"I agree," Wingham said with another bow, "and I would not, if there was another way to prompt you to action."
Nyungi rocked back a bit and considered the words.
"A construct, you say?"
"I am certain that if you climbed to your highest room and looked out your north window, you could see it from here."
Nyungi glanced back into the room behind him, and the rickety staircase ascending the right-hand wall.
"I do not much leave the lowest floor. I doubt I could climb those stairs."
He was grinning when he turned back to Wingham, then kept turning to I. Olgercon.
"But perhaps your large friend here might assist me. Might assist us both if your legs are as old as my own."
Wingham didn't need the help of Olgercon to climb the stairs, though the wooden railing was fragile and wobbly, with many balusters missing or leaning out or in, no longer attached to the rail. The old merchant led the way, with Olgercon carrying Nyungi close behind and occasionally putting his hand out to steady Wingham. The staircase rose about 15 feet, opening onto a balcony that ran the breadth of the wide foyer and back again. Across the way, a second staircase climbed to the third story. That one seemed more solid, with balusters all in place, but it hadn't been used in years, obviously, and Wingham had to brush away cobwebs to continue. As the stairs spilled out on the south side of the house, Wingham had to follow the balcony all the way back around the other side to the north room's door. He glanced back when he got there, for Nyungi was walking again and had lost ground with his pronounced limp. Nyungi waved for him to go on, and so he pressed through the door, crossing to the far window where he pulled aside the drape. Staring out to the north, Wingham nearly fell over, for though he had expected to view the growing castle, he didn't expect how dominant the structure would be from so far away. Only a few days had passed since Wingham had ventured to the magical book, and the structure growing behind it, and the castle was many times the size it had been. Wingham couldn't see the book from so great a distance, obviously, but the circular stone keep that grew behind it was clearly visible, rising high above the Vossen plain. More startling was the fact that the keep was far to the back of the structure, centering a back wall anchored by two smaller round towers at its corners. From those, the walls moved south toward Palaszczuk, and Wingham could see the signs of a growing central gatehouse at what he knew would be the front wall of the upper bailey. Several other structures were growing before the gatehouse as well, an outer bailey and a lower wall already climbed up from the ground.
"By the gods! What did he do?"
old Nyungi asked, coming up beside Wingham.
"He left us some presents, so it would seem," Wingham answered.
"It seems almost a replica of Castle Perilous, curse the name," Nyungi remarked.
Wingham looked over at the old bard, knowing well that Nyungi was one of the few still alive who had glimpsed that terrible place during the height of Zheng Yi's power.
"A wizard did this,"
Nyungi said.
"Zheng Yi, as I explained."
"No, my old friend Wingham, I mean now. A wizard did this. A wizard served as a catalyst to bring life to the old power of the Witch King, now."
"Some curses are without end,"
Wingham replied. But he held back the rest of his thoughts concerning Arrayan and his own foolishness in handing her the book. He had thought it an instruction manual for necromancy, or golem creation, or a history, perhaps. He could never have imagined the truth of it.
"Please come out with me, Nyungi," Wingham bade.
"To there?"
the old man said with a horrified look.
"My adventuring days are long behind me, I fear. I have no strength to do battle with—"
"Not there," Wingham explained. "To the house of a friend. My niece, who is in need of your wisdom at this darkening hour."
Nyungi looked at Wingham with unveiled curiosity and asked,
"The wizard?"
Wingham's grim expression was all the answer the older half-orc needed. Wingham soon found that Olgercon had not been exaggerating in his insistence that the old merchant go quickly to Arrayan. The woman appeared many times worse than before. Her skin was pallid and seemed bereft of fluid, like gray, dry paper. She tried to rise up from the bed, where Olgercon had propped her almost to a sitting position with pillows, but Wingham could see that the strain was too great, and he quickly waved her back to her more comfortable repose. Arrayan looked past Wingham and Olgercon to the hunched, elderly half-orc. Her expression fast shifted from inviting to suspicious.
"Do you know my friend Nyungi?"
Wingham asked her. Arrayan continued to carefully scrutinize the old half-orc, some spark of distant recognition showing in her tired eyes.
"Nyungi is well-versed in the properties of magic," Wingham explained. "He will help us help you."
"Magic?"
Arrayan asked, her voice weak. Nyungi came forward and leaned over her.
"Little Arrayan Maggot Sweeper," he said.
The woman winced at the sound of her name.
"Always a curious sort you were when you were young. I am not surprised to learn that you are a wizard. A mighty one, if that castle is any indication."
Arrayan absorbed the compliment just long enough to recognize the implication behind it. Then her face screwed up with horror.
"I did not create the castle," she said.
Nyungi started to respond, but he stopped short, as if he had just caught on to her claim.
"Pardon my mistake," he said at last.
The old half-orc bent lower to look into her eyes. He bade Olgercon to go and fetch her some water or some soup, spent a few more moments scrutinizing her, then backed off as the larger half-orc returned. With a nod, Nyungi motioned for Wingham to escort him back into the house's front room.
"She is not ill,"
the old bard explained when they had moved out of Arrayan's chamber.
"Not sick, you mean?"
Nyungi nodded.
"I knew it before we arrived. but in looking at her I am certain beyond doubt. That is no poison or disease. She was healthy just a few days ago, correct?
Dancing lightly on her pretty feet when she first came to greet me upon my arrival.
It is the magic, Nyungi reasoned. Jenyi has done this before.
How?
The book is a trap. It is not a tome of creation, but one of self-creation. Once one of suitable magical power begins to read it, it entraps that person's life essence. As the castle grows, it does so at the price of Arayan's life force, intellect, and magical prowess. She is creating the castle subconsciously.
For how long? Wingham asked,
and he stepped over and glanced with concern into the bedroom.
Until she is dead, I would guess, said Nyungi, consumed by the creation. I doubt that the merciless Jenyi would stop short of such an eventuality out of compassion for his unwitting victim.
How can we stop this? Wingham asked.
Nyungi glanced past him with concern, then painted a look of grim dread on his face when he again met Wingham's stare.
No. You cannot,
Wingham said with sudden understanding.
That castle is a threat, growing, and growing stronger, reasoned Nyungi. Your niece is lost, I fear. There is nothing I can do, certainly, nor can anyone else in Palaszczuk, to slow the progression that will surely kill her.
We have healers,
who will be powerless at best,
answered the older half-orc.
Or, if they are not, and offer Arayan some relief, then that might only add to the energy being channeled into the growth of Jenyi's monstrosity. I understand your hesitance here, my friend. She is your relation. Beloved. I can see from your eyes when you look upon her. But do you not remember the misery of Jenyi? Would you, in your false compassion, help foster a return to that?
Wingham glanced back into the room once more and said,
You cannot know all this for sure. There is much presumption here.
I know, Wingham. This is not mere coincidence, and you know, too.
As he finished, Nyungi moved to the counter and found a long kitchen knife.
I will be quick about it. She will not see the strike coming. Let us pray it is not too late to save her soul and to diminish the evil she has unwittingly wrought.
Wingham could hardly breathe, could hardly stand. He tried to digest Youngie's words and reasoning, looking for some flaw, for some sliver of hope. He instinctively put his arm out to block the old half-orc, but Nyungi moved with a purpose that he had not known in many, many years. He brushed by Wingham and into the bedroom and bade Olgercon to stand aside. The large half-orc did just that, leaving the way open to Arayan, who was resting back with her eyes closed and her breathing shallow. Nyungi knew much of the world around Palaszczuk. He had spent his decades adventuring, touring the countryside as a wandering minstrel, a collector of information and song alike. He had traveled extensively with Wingham for years as well, studying magic and magical items. He had served in Jenyi's army in the early days of the Witch King's rise, before the awful truth about the horrible creature was fully realized. Nyungi didn't doubt his guess about the insidious bond that had been created between the book and the reader, nor did he question the need for him to do his awful deed before the castle's completion. His mind was still sharp. He knew much. What he did not comprehend was the depth of the bond between Arayan and Olgercon. He didn't think to hide his intent as he brandished that long knife and moved toward the helpless woman. Something in his eyes betrayed him to Olgercon. Something in his forward, eager posture told the young half-orc warrior that the old half-orc was about no healing exercise, at least not in any manner Olgercon's sensibilities would allow.
Nyungi lurched for Aroyan's throat and was stopped cold by a powerful hand latching onto his forearm. He struggled to pull away, but he might as well have been trying to stop a running horse.
"Let me go, you oaf!"
he scolded, and Aroyan opened her eyes to regard the two of them standing before her. Olger Khan turned his wrist over, easily forcing Nyungi's knife hand up into the air, and the old half-orc grimaced in pain.
"I must! You do not understand," Nyungi argued.
Olger Khan looked from Nyungi to Wingham, who stood in the doorway.
"It is for her own good,"
Nyungi protested.
"Like bloodletting for poison, you see."
Olger Khan continued to look to Wingham for answers. Nyungi went on struggling, then froze in place when he heard Wingham say,
"He means to kill her, Olger Khan."
Nyungi's eyes went wide, and wider still, when the young, strong half-orc's fist came soaring in to smack him in the face, launching him backward and to the floor, where he knew no more. Chapter 11 Palaszczuk's Shadow.
"Hurry!"
Kalahe shouted at Entreri.
"Drive them harder!"
Entreri grunted in reply, but did not put the whip to the team. He understood her desperation, but it was hardly his problem. Across a wide expanse of rocky ground with patches of mud, far up ahead loomed the low skyline of Palaszczuk. They were still some time away from the city, Entreri knew, and if he drove the team any harder, the horses would likely collapse before they reached the gates. Jarlaxle sat behind him on the bench, with Athrogate next to him, far to Entreri's left. Pratkis sat in the back, along with Kalahe and the two wounded, the soldier Davis Aang, and Kalahe's broken companion, Parissus.
"Harder, I say! On your life!"
Kalahe screamed from behind. Entreri resisted the urge to pull the team up. Jarlaxle put a hand on his forearm, and when he glanced at the drow, Jarlaxle motioned for him to not respond. In truth, Entreri wasn't thinking about shouting back at the desperate woman, though the thought of drawing his dagger, leaping back and cutting out her wagging tongue occurred to him more than once. A second hand landed on the assassin's other shoulder, and he snapped his cold and threatening glare back the other way, face to face with Pratkis.
"The Lady Parissus is sure to be dying," the dwarf explained. "She's got moments and no more."
"I cannot drive them faster than," Entreri started to reply, but the dwarf cut him short with an upraised hand and a look that showed no explanation was needed.
"I'm only telling ye, so ye don't go back and shut the poor girl up," Pratkis explained. "Them half-elves are a bit on the lamenting side, if ye get me meaning."
"There is nothing you can do for the woman," Jarlaxle asked.
"I get all I can handle in keeping Davis Aang alive," Pratkis explained. "And he weren't much hurt at all in comparison, except a bit of acid burns. It's the damn bites she got, so many of them. Poison they were, and a nasty bit of the stuff. And Parissus, she'd be dying without the poison, though I'm sure there's enough to kill all of us running through her veins."
"Then have Athrogate smash her skull," Entreri said. "Be done with it and done with her pain."
"She's far beyond any pain, I'm thinking."
"More's the pity," said Entreri.
"He gets like that when he's frustrated," Jarlaxle quipped. He received a perfectly vicious look from Entreri, and of course, the drow responded with a disarming grin.
"That soldier gonna live then?"
asked Athrogate, but Pratkis could only shrug. Behind them all, Kalahe cried out,
"Save me a swat,"
Athrogate remarked, understanding, as did they all from the hollow and helpless timbre of the shriek, that death had at last come poor Parissus. Kalahe continued to wail, even after Pratkis joined her and tried to comfort her.
"Might be needing a swat anyway,"
Athrogate muttered after a few moments of the keening. Ellery pulled her horse up beside the rolling wagon, inquiring of the cleric for Parissus and her soldier.
"Nasty bit of poison,"
Entreri and Jarlaxle heard the dwarf remark.
"We're not even to the city, and two are down," Entreri said to the drow.
two less to split the treasures that no doubt await us at the end of our road. Entreri didn't bother to reply. A short while later, the Palaszczuk skyline much clearer before them, the troop noted the circle of brightly colored wagons set before the city's southern wall. At that point, Maria Brown galloped past the wagon moving far ahead.